edition of the Cusp Show, the Columbia University Sports Podcast, a podcast where we talk about the business of sports and the trends in sports with interesting personalities and executives. I'm joined today, as usual, by my trusty co-host, Joe Favorito. Welcome, Joe.
Thanks, Tom. What are we talking about today?
We're talking about a topic with a special guest that I think you and I are both really excited about, someone we've had the privilege of knowing for a while, someone who's a legend in the sports business, particularly on the media side of the sports business, someone who's just a great guy, someone we've recently welcomed to the world of academia after a stellar career, or not after, but as he continues a stellar career in the sports business. Someone I think both of us have worked with in some different capacities at various points, and that someone is Ross Greenberg. So welcome, Ross. How are you?
Hey, great to be with both of you.
Thank you. And let me just remind everybody, for the probably the very few number of listeners who don't know about you, Ross is currently the head of his own production business called Ross Greenberg Productions, which he started 5 years ago after an amazing career, primarily or maybe even exclusively, Ross will talk about this, at HBO, where he was most recently the president of HBO Sports. So he's an Emmy Award winner. He's a well-known executive in the sports world, particularly in the New York area. And we have a lot to talk about. So we're going to try to address a few things, Joe, as we get into this with Ross. So with no further ado, Ross, why don't we start with just kind of your version of the introduction, because you've done a lot in this business, and there's so many interesting stories that you've been part of along the way. But why don't you just actually just frame it all out, and then we can jump into the meat of the discussion.
Wow. Well, it started for me probably in high school because I was very close friends and actually a football teammate of Kyle Gifford, whose father happened to be the one and only and great Frank Gifford. And so Frank introduced the two of us to ABC Sports, and we were fortunate enough to become kind of freelance production assistants at various golf tournaments early on, the U.S. Open at Wingfoot being probably the most prominent. And college, even though Mom wanted me to go to law school, I kind of had gotten the bug of sports television. It felt like I was going to Disneyland to work. And, you know, sports were in my blood, and Frank was like a second father. And so when I graduated from Brown, I immediately started working as a freelance production assistant at ABC Sports in its heyday. And for those of you who are too young to know, ABC Sports was where every single major event seemed to be in those
mm-hmm.
days. And then from there, I didn't get a staff job at ABC, and Denny Lewin had me in his office and said, Ross, I'm sorry, but we've hired five other people as production assistants. You should really look for a job. So I went to a cable source book and found Home Box Office. And that was February of 1978. I was given a job by HBO, one of two people in the production department. And from that point on, I kind of took flight at HBO, and kind of the rest is history. Developed a lot of unique programming with a similar tone to everything that Rune Arledge had done at ABC Sports. And along the years, we, you know, produced some real compelling documentaries, magazine shows, launched Hard Knocks, Real Sports, 24/7, and about 100 documentaries from the 80s through 2011 when I left. And when I left, I decided, you know what, I'm not done. I'm going to keep doing this. And so, you know, by the grace of God, NBC Sports and the National Hockey League and Epix and Showtime and Fox and a lot of networks have allowed me to continue to produce documentaries and reality sports series. So I'm still here.
So, Ross, can we just back up the tape a little bit? I think for the uninitiated, a lot of people don't realize how small and, frankly, back then in history, insignificant HBO was at that in television history. So what exactly were they doing in the late 70s. I don't even remember that. And then could you just quickly just do a kind of a run through of how it grew to be such a major player in this world of entertainment and sports?
Yeah. I mean, for, you know, when I got to HBO, there were 90 employees, there were 500,000 subs in all 50 states, but it was, you know, I'd go places for HBO and the people would ask me who you work for, and I'd say HBO, and they go, what? Who? What's that? And that's how it started. And the great Michael Fuchs, I would credit him most with interjecting a kind of a life into HBO and giving it a programming vision so that it would become the force that you know it today. In sports, I realized early on that, you know, we weren't going to be competing for live sports events other than boxing, which we found a niche. And Michael was very dedicated to the sport of boxing and knew we could form a pretty powerful kind of position in that sport. But we knew we couldn't compete for NFL football, even though we tried in the first cable package. We fought with ESPN for the rights to the Sunday night package. We lost out in 1986. But I knew that there were other forms of programming, whether it be magazine shows or documentaries or what became reality shows, that could kind of give us the preeminent voice as storytellers in sports. I was influenced by people like Steve Sable and Bud Greenspan and others, and I found my voice and kind of led the charge at HBO Sports to kind of do the kind of programming that it's known for today. So none of that, you know, all of that evolved over a long period of time. I mean, we had our first stab at a sports magazine show in the early 80s, and it was a handwritten 1994 memo that I wrote in the days of memos, by the way, no email, to Michael Fuchs, you know, spearheading the beginnings of real sports. And, you know, because I knew we had it in us, it was just a question of timing. And lo and behold, real sports came to be, and the rest is history, really.
So one other thing along the TV side for those who aren't aware, HBO actually did Wimbledon, correct, at one point?
Yeah. Oh, I went to London 21 straight years.
Yep. Was a big player at Wimbledon. And there was a time I seem to remember, and I'm going to say this was like Lee Leonard and Spencer Ross doing – didn't they do NBA games or ABA games at one point? Or
yeah,
tennis,
well, we did.
World Team
we actually, before I even got to HBO, believe it or not, the network that broadcast the finals of the last finals of the ABA with the great Julius Erving and the New York Nets was HBO. HBO had the broadcast rights to the ABA at the end of its life. When I got there in 78, Tom, you had asked, you know, we were doing things like a college basketball game of the week. My second year there in 1979, we did a regular season game between Indiana State and Michigan State, who had two pretty good players on each of their teams, Larry Bird and Magic Johnson, which was the first time that the two would meet on the basketball court as collegians, I think. And so, or maybe they had met. No, I don't even know if they had
That was the first game they played each other.
So HBO broadcast it. Tom Heinsohn at the mic with Dick Stockton, who was the broadcaster. You know, and Marty Glickman was a big part of our programming mix then, too. I want to remind people, the great Marty Glickman, who basically was never given credit for this, which is a great story. Talk about the business of sports. So Marty figured that, and this ties into Wimbledon, he figured that there was no reason why people should have to wait for the weekend to watch Wimbledon on NBC. So he was the one that marched over to London with Mark McCormick at the time and convinced the All England Club to sell HBO the midweek rights to the Wimbledon Championships. And at that time, there was never a golf tournament or a tennis tournament which was broadcast during the week. So Marty invented the broadcast of any major sporting event, you know, when it comes to tennis or golf, for midweek coverage.
Wow.
How's
wow.
that?
I didn't know that. I want to actually, if you don't mind, Joe, let me just go back to a name that Ross mentioned kind of in passing that I think we'd be fun to spend a couple minutes on because he's such a key guy in the world of sports media, and that is Steve Sable. Because as Ross, you guys know, I worked at the NFL and got to do a little bit of business during my years there with NFL Films and Steve. And I was always amazed as a non-production and a non-television person. I was just always amazed. I grew up like a lot of people that, on a diet of NFL Films videos as a kid when there was serious scarcity in the market of NFL content. So I just had this admiration for Ed Sable, his father, and Steve. And it was just a real honor to meet him. And I'll never forget my first visit to NFL Films down in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. It's kind of a stunning thing to see. I'm sure, Ross, you've spent a lot of time there in your career.
Yeah.
So could you talk about him for a few minutes and some of your memories?
I'd love to hear
your perspective on Hard Knocks, which is a show that I've loved since day one, and I've watched every episode ever produced.
Which Steve and I had to figure out the blueprint. And one of the funniest stories I have to tell you, first of all, you know, that was the first sports reality show. Now, having said that, Steve in the 60s had started miking some former coaches. You may know some of their names, like Vince Lombardi, and put mics on them at practice and started to put together one-hour documentaries that looked at the entire year in the life of the Green Bay Packers and the great Vince Lombardi. So he was way ahead of his time in terms of documenting the reality of NFL football, including miking Hank Stram in Super Bowl IV, and starting to mic players very frequently, Dick Butkus, a host of others, through those 60s and 70s. And Steve, early on, knew that he could create an imagery in that sport that would capture people's imagination, and you throw John Facenda's voice in there as the narrator, and you've got something really special that tugged at the heart of Tom Richardson. So that was Steve in a nutshell. I will also tell you that when we did Hard Knocks the first time around, it was an interesting kind of incubator for how these shows would develop. We sat in a room for many hours and on the phone, and we discussed, okay, what do we want to do? What are our stories here? And one of the things that Steve was very frank about was that we have to give them a dose of reality. The reason it was on HBO was that language was going to have to be in that would be unacceptable to the networks, because that's the way coaches talk, and that's the way players talk, and that's the way it is. You know, in the locker room and off the field. So, and even on the field. So that became a standard. Then we started to look at, okay, do we want to follow rookies? You know, do we want to follow the guys on the bubble who may or may not make the team, the veterans that are a little past their prime? Do we want to get into the chemistry of how, you know, rookies are integrated into the team, the pranks that go on, and the tough moments, you know. And so, you know, we set out to kind of figure all of that out. I will also tell you one of the funniest moments with Steve was we were doing our first press conference for the Ravens, or we were doing – it might have been the Cincinnati Bengals, actually, a couple years later. And we were at the press conference announcing – that the Bengals were going to do this show with us. And a writer raised his hand and said, well, Steve, what's it like to produce Hard Knocks? You know, how do you guys get it done and how do you turn it around so quickly? Because I will remind people that it also is something that had never been tried before, to shoot a show and in 7 days put 150 hours of television into 1 hour and put it on the air. So Steve said, well, think of it as like building a plane in mid-flight. and you know, I always quote that. I always use that in any interview I ever do, because in many ways, that's what this sports reality drama television is all about. You are actually taking little subplots and stories, melding them together, and building your plane or your show in mid-flight. And, you know, that sums up the mind, the creativity, the brilliance of Steve Sable.
So talking about the shows that you've done and the show that's coming starting in mid-December on December 14th, The Road to the Winter Classics, can you talk to people about how you kind of win over, whether it's NHL coaches and players, NFL players, to get the buy-in, to get the access that you have, and then kind of how does it work different now with the – is it any different from the NHL to when you've done it with the NFL or other people? Why does the NHL in-season work so well versus other sports?
I'll tell you the truth. It's related to Steve, and I saw him work, you know, the NFL teams, and I worked the NFL teams as well because I was the one that spent a year trying to get the New York Jets to do Hard Knocks, knowing that Rex was going to light up the screen and it would be a wonderful season. But I will tell you that, you know, trust is the word. You have to gain a trust with those different teams in order to not only initiate Hard Knocks or any behind-the-scenes show like our Road to the Winter Classic or Outdoor Classic series that we're doing now for the NHL, and you have to explain that you're going to be a fly on the wall, allow them to do their jobs in preparation for games and during the regular season, and you are going to be unobtrusive and a fly on the wall, as I said, and going to document their daily, you know, goings on and stay out of their way, and then make them proud as they turn around and watch, you know, that week's episode documenting their world. And, you know, very early on, probably inspired by Steve, I decided in this series, particularly in the NHL, that nothing is different, really. Even though the games change from NFL football to NHL hockey, if you bring the cameras low to the ice, like Steve did with his cameras for the NFL, if you put microphones on refs and two players and the coach and go into the locker rooms and listen in before, during, and after the game, and you know, we're there every second recording what's going on, you can electrify people when you marry it to sound and story and music and a great narrator. And that goes back to the basics of what NFL Films was and is, and what we try to do and replicate with magicians in the edit room, I might add, guys like Tim Mullen and Andrew Romero and Chris Nietzsche, names you don't even know, that are sitting in those edit rooms and so gifted at putting this, you know, and bringing this whole thing to life. And great shooters in the field like Steve LeMay and Mike Bozzo and Dom Savio. You don't know those names, but these are the Tom Brady's of their craft. And if you assemble those kinds of teams, production teams, you're going to come out with the New England Patriots in television. Period.
And then can you just walk everybody through, before we move off kind of the upcoming series of the NHL and the work you've done with the NHL, walk everybody through kind of what that edit day is like? Because having been in the room, it's a pretty amazing experience with a writer like Aaron Cohen sitting there almost taking things on the fly and adjusting, especially when you get new news. Like, I mean, for example, a couple of years ago with the Blackhawks, there was a member of the staff, training staff or the fitness staff, that died during the season, and you had to adjust on the fly. Walk everybody through that, what it's like on that Thursday from around midnight until the show actually goes out the door and tries to get approval from the NHL and the teams from a time standpoint.
Yeah, I mean, you can get a late-breaking story that has to be in the show journalistically. And in that particular case, one of the equipment managers passed away probably 24 hours before we were going to air. And frankly, I had to come up with a way to gracefully tell the story at the end of one of our episodes but also maintain the drama of it all, frankly. So I knew that Coach Q was having his press conference, and he was very tied to this equipment manager, as was the rest of the Chicago Blackhawk team. And I knew that it would be very emotional, so the directive went out to the cameraman at the time, Pete Francella, to shoot him very tight so that we could see the emotion on his face and his expression. And he did start to cry and get some tears in his eyes. And we decided at that moment, I decided, that that would be the way that we would sign off that particular episode. And those are the kinds of decisions and the kinds of stories and dramatic moments that can come up right till airtime. And you have to be prepared to incorporate those into the broadcast. Now, you know, sometimes it can be a key injury. I remember Taves went up against the boards and, you know, was speaking to the trainer on the ice about the possibilities of him, you know, being dinged, and he started going through concussion protocol, and our cameraman instinctively knew to take him off the ice and take him back to the trainer's room. Those are the kinds of instincts you have to kind of get out of the people that work for you, that know that they're witness to a story that can break at any moment.
So, Ross, what happens with the team owner, the team you're focused on, and the commissioner's office with the week-to-week edits and approvals?
At the end of the edit, when we're done with our finished product, we have to send it out the day before in the morning to both teams. And the NHL is obviously screening it with us as well. And all three organizations, including the NHLPA, have to, you know, give their thumbs up and look for any little pieces that might, you know, be something strategic that the teams don't want out there. At times, the whiteboards that are behind the coaches become problematic because they might have diagrams of certain plays on them, you know, lists of individuals that they're keying on. And so we have to take out, you know, something like the address, the number address of a player's house, because you don't want him to deal with people just coming up to their house on a daily basis. So it's a very strenuous part of the process. But at the end of the day, we've been fortunate that, you know, we know what's off limits before it even gets to that point, usually. So at the point where on Thursday for a Friday air, you know, there's very little that you should be changed at that point.
And then, Ross, what's the reaction? How many years has HBO been doing Hard Knocks?
So HBO started Hard Knocks in 2000, and and there were a couple years where we didn't do it because couldn't get teams to cooperate. And but then I think since I left in 2011, they've done it every year.
Yeah, all right. So my last question on this topic is a simple one. What did the players in the NFL and the NHL think of this? I would imagine, especially in this age of incessant self-promotion and media activity, they must like it. I assume they like it, don't they?
You can't generalize like that because there are going to be a couple players on each team that hate it, frankly, and don't really want you there and don't really want to cooperate. And you know who they are, and you kind of stay away from them. It's not they don't like you as people. It's just they're very committed to their job, and even though you're a fly on the wall, they still look at you as a distraction. So no, you're not going to get 100% buy-in. Some will be, a lot more involved than others. I mean, I'm smiling because P.K. Subban, Max Pacioretty told me when I met with him a week before we started shooting, he said, "Well, PK's never seen a camera he didn't like, so you'll have no problem with PK." And sure enough, you know, he was there for us whenever we needed him. and he lit up the screen, and he's an unbelievable personality. He's also now in Tennessee. He's not in Montreal.
Right.
So, you know, I don't think our show had anything to do with that. But the fact is that, you know, you have a wide range of players. But for the most part, they start to miss us when we leave. That's the
right.
funny thing. At the end of the
right.
5 weeks of shooting, I can't tell you how many times our producers and cameramen, you know, get hugs from the players,
mm-hmm.
and they miss them a day later
right.
because they were part of
right.
the team.
All right, that's great. So just I thought of one last one because I got to ask this. I'm just curious as a fan. Who of all the years you worked on these shows, who was the most interesting, most enthusiastic, most cooperative and productive individual you got?
Well, it's hard for me. I mean, look, I'm a New York Jet fan since 1963 when my dad got season tickets. I worked a year to get Rex and Woody and the Jets.
Right.
So Rex, I think, two people. One would be Rex Ryan, and then in the world of boxing, remember, we did our 24/7s, I would
mm-hmm.
have to say Mr. Floyd Mayweather are the two
mm-hmm.
most dynamic personalities that have ever been involved in this form of television. And in both cases, you know, their performances, if you want to call them performances, because I think they are real. You get what you see. I got to know both of those gentlemen very well. They weren't mugging for the camera. That's who they are on a daily basis. And particularly with Rex, I would say you know, that will go down as one of the most memorable 5 weeks of programming in sports television history.
Right.
So speaking of sports television, the shows that you've talked about, pretty much HBO does get a rating now, but channels like Showtime and Epix and now Netflix and Amazon are not ratings based.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that has obviously come up and has become a big bugaboo, and it's going to sound like Allen Iverson talking about practice. Everybody's talking about
mm-hmm.
practice. Well, people keep talking about ratings, all about ratings.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about where people are judging ratings today, and then what are networks going to have to do going forward to figure out the way to make sure that they're capturing an engaged audience and measuring an engaged audience, in your opinion?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think you're seeing it now that you know, the networks I know are all looking at cumulative ratings. And what I mean by cumulative is not only the premier rating, which everyone seems obsessed with, particularly with live sports like the NFL, as you've seen this, you know, this question mark being planted on the NFL. Is it going through a declined rating period here? But I think the reality is now that you have to gauge not only whether you're watching a show, but whether you're emotionally being satisfied by the show. You know, it's funny, way back when, in the late 70s, early 80s, when HBO first started, we would have two forms of ratings. When finally Nielsen started paying attention to HBO, they did so, but we also had what we called a satisfaction rating. We did tests and called people and found out if they actually enjoyed the show and not only watched it but enjoyed and were satisfied by the show. So I
wow.
think that is more important to me as a producer than just a rating. And I would argue that when we produce, you know, these kinds of reality series like this NHL series or some hard-hitting docus. I have one coming up on Showtime on Lawrence Phillips. You know, they are powerful pieces of television, and we get a lot of feedback and buzz created off of our shows. Does it become water cooler talk? Does it become dinner party talk? Is it the kind of talk you hear when you're at a restaurant from the next table? Did you see blah, blah, blah? Did you see that NHL series that Epix just did? Wow. You know, that's what television's all about, connecting to the viewer, not just having people tune in for 5 minutes and say they watched it.
Right, but Ross, I think
That's a fair point. I agree, but I guess the reality that the pay television networks and cable companies are facing is that, unlike what you've experienced at, as a head of HBO Sports, which had a different business model, of course, than a network, typical network, and also your independent production company, the mainstream business with the live rights is obviously a business based on ratings for advertising sales purposes. So the emotion, I agree with you about the emotional side, and we can see some of that happening on the digital platforms where you can, to a certain degree in different ways, register your level of interest and engagement kind of emotionally. But in the kind of cruel world of mainstream pay television, it's Nielsen rating points still that drive the business.
But
so
I think the business
model
is changing.
Yeah.
I think not only the pay television networks, but also even the networks themselves have to understand that there's the Netflixation of watching television now. You know that there's so many people out there binge-watching series now that the whole world's going to be turned upside down. So, you know, networks have to get used to the fact, whether it's CBS or ABC, NBC, Fox, you know, they all have to understand that people are going to start watching The Good Wife seasons 1 through 6 on some other form of distribution. So that's why you're seeing, you know, the attraction of live sports, because it's the one thing you can't binge watch. No one's going to go back and look at Super Bowls 1 through 10. Maybe a couple people will, but the bottom line is that, you know, you have to follow where your viewers go. And understand that if you obsess over premier ratings because you have to fulfill some advertising obligations, you better look for getting those advertisers planted somehow else into your means of distribution in order to make that revenue stream last, or figure out some other way or some other revenue stream to make up for what might become a dying stream of money, and that's the bottom line. I mean, ratings, you know, they have to pay attention to ratings. I'm not saying you can't pay attention to ratings, but you better do it with the mindset that viewer habits are changing, and you better react to that.
Well, so what do you think related to that topic? There's a new genre of programming that has infiltrated the sports and entertainment television business, which is esports, which we're now seeing on Turner. We're now seeing it on ESPN. We're seeing a lot of mainstream professional sports team owners invest in this space, and I suspect it's obviously huge on Over the Top. I suspect more of it will be coming to mainstream television. Do you think that is going to be a significant disruptive force that will challenge the time and attention from viewers on the other sports?
Well, it's funny. I understand the fascination. I'm not a millennial. I never played those games. I watched my son play it a little bit. He doesn't even play it anymore. He's 28 years old. But the fact is that, you know, I've seen 3D come and go. I've seen HD come and stay. I really believe I've seen poker come and go, even though it's still on television a little bit. But I think we can all remember the incredible craze that took place for a couple years when poker hit ESPN and you know, became a very hot new sport, quote unquote, on television. I think the jury is out, frankly. I don't think anyone yet has figured out how to translate that particular game action into a television show. A guy that used to work for me at HBO, when he went to ESPN and was given the directive to figure out a way to put poker on television, put little cameras covering just the hand that people were dealt, and all of a sudden, you know, he created this tension and drama, and people started watching it. Now, someone's got to do that with esports, because, you know, so far I've heard from other people, because I haven't watched it, that it really doesn't hook people on television yet. And if it doesn't ever hook people on television, then it's going to fail. I don't care what they do. Now, that doesn't mean they can't put 20,000 people in Madison Square Garden as someone from Thailand plays someone from New York on a video game, which, you know, could be very entertaining live to people that do that kind of stuff. But until it becomes a really powerful television show, the jury's going to be out.
So what other sports in particular do you think have longer-term high potential on television right now that just have not been as popular, let's say, in the media realm during your career, but that will change over time?
Well, I mean, I can remember for 30 years people questioned whether soccer would ever become a viable sport in America. And people used to say, well, all the kids are playing it. Why isn't it a bigger sport here, knowing that it was doing well in Europe? And lo and behold, over the last decade, you've seen the World Cup become one of the premier sports events in the United States of America. I just used a sentence that people would have thought was a little crazy 20 years ago. So I definitely think sports here to stay, and I know there's a real huge market out there for the Premier League and a lot of other tournaments that pop up throughout the year that are now world events. I don't know of any other sport that really seems to have taken hold. I like to think that college lacrosse will start to become more and more significant, because I'm seeing kind of a spike in not only kids playing the sport, but also it's a great television sport that does translate. I don't think the professional level will get there, but I think the collegiate game will pick up some steam. I don't know what UFC is. I'd love to tell you that it's the hottest sport in America, but I just always feel like, and yes, they do, you know, every once in a while, a Ronda Rousey or a Conor McGregor kind of take on a larger-than-life personality and become transcendent to the sport. And yet, as a sport itself, I know there's millions and millions of people that find it completely unwatchable. There are also millions and millions of people that think it's one of the best sports out there. But when you talk about the word growth, I don't know if there's more growth to that sport. There are quite a few sports out there. I do know one thing. I've always said that sports is probably the most non-respected, powerful medium of entertainment in our culture. It seems to be me that, you know, there's so many business people out there that look at sports as, oh, those are the kids that go and play in the playground, you know, and don't really have real jobs. But we're seeing how powerful sports is as a force in entertainment now.
Yeah. Ross, we're going to wrap in a few minutes, but I wanted to ask you a quick question about something I mentioned in the intro, which was your foray into the world of higher education and teaching. So this past fall, you started teaching at Iona College, where they've got an MBA program with a sports management certificate, one that I used to be involved with as well, with our friend and colleague Glenn Herein. So would love to get your impressions on that. You did it for a few months. I think you wrapped up recently. What do you think? Are you going to come back for round two?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think, I've always had it in my blood, frankly. For years, I've gone up to Brown, my alma mater, and taught a class once a semester, one day a semester, and really enjoy interacting with our, 20-something young people, because first of all, I feel like I'm their age, but second of all, I really, really admire their curiosity and their brilliance, frankly, and, I had the pleasure of going going 12 straight weeks at Iona, which my dad graduated from, so I did have a tie there. He actually had 3 years of college and then ended up going into World War II and had to wait till he was 56 years old to get his fourth year at Iona, which he did because we were living up in Scarsdale, New York at the time. But more importantly, I just really love the interaction, you know, with the students, and I find them fascinating. Their number one assignment was to come up for a treatment for a television show or series or film or whatever they wanted. And I would say of the 18 students that I had, there were probably 7 or 8 treatments that I could bring into anyone in television and probably get sold. That's how smart they were. Yeah.
Wow.
So I kidded them. I said, well, you know, you guys are so talented that, you know, this might be the most money ever made from a class. And, you know, obviously I would take them all in as partners if I ever sold any of their ideas. So they could go from the classroom to being producers of a mainstream television show or
That's
film.
Terrific.
So, Ross, right before we let you go, we'd like to ask a couple questions of all our guests. One is, and I'll ask one, and then Tom can ask the other one and wrap it up. Where do you get your information from? Like, what are your go-to sources during the course of a day or a week where you're keeping up to date on kind of everything that's going on, whether it affects a show like Road to the Outdoor Classic or whether it's just general news about the industry?
I'd say, you know, I'm one of those guys on the internet that goes to some favorite sites. A couple in the industry would be Awful Announcing, and even though the name kind of throws you off a bit, it's a quality, you know, what's happening in the now website. I also go to Deadline Hollywood a lot. I also go to Yahoo and ESPN, and really dig a little deeper to see what's going on and, you know, the world of football or hockey or whatever, just to stay tuned, you know, to the news, because obviously when you're launching a series like I am next week following 4 NHL teams, you better know where they are and who's hot and the fact that Hoss is, you know, scoring some game-winning goals in every game now becomes important if you're going to follow the Blackhawks. So, but I'm constantly, you know, Sports Business Journal is a great resource. I always tell students and younger people that they should really go after that because it's a constant reminder of where the jobs really are, where the growth companies are, where the industry is buzzing, what the changes are. Online, a lot of great websites kind of have followed me around, like Synopsis and others that kind of this Promax Media website popped up a couple years ago. And today, for instance, I found out that True TV is becoming a comedy channel, unbeknownst to me until this morning when I picked up that. So there's constantly kind of a lot of information at your fingertips.
Yeah. So, Russ, last question is about careers and career development, career advice. You've obviously hired and mentored tons of young people throughout your career, and now you've got interactions with them at Iona. What kind of career advice can you offer someone starting his or her career, let's say in their mid-20s, right now?
Most importantly, you know, obviously you hear the word passion a lot, so you should make a career of something you're passionate about. So I picked sports television. I knew it was in my blood. I loved the drama and telling stories and all of that. So I found my love. And I think it's important, I always tell students to interview themselves before they sit down and interview with anyone in the business world, because the most important thing is to figure out what you want and what you think is your passion. And then follow your lead and look for the specific kinds of jobs that work within your passion. And that really is what I found most effective in a career. And, you know, I think once students are honest with themselves, look at the, and also use your experience and background as an asset. If you're in finance right now but outside of the world of sports, well, then look for finance jobs in sports if you want to start crossing over. Don't just immediately say, well, I'm going to drop everything and the last 10 years of my life were meaningless. Now I want something in sports or I want something in music. You know, you have to kind of look for your niche and know what's on your resume that you can look forward to kind of sitting in an interview room and saying to that person, well, I've had this background in finance or in marketing in this world, but I think it easily translates into the world of sports or music or wherever you find your heart going.
What a great conversation. What a fascinating discussion about an amazing career, Ross. Thank you so much, Ross Greenberg of Ross Greenberg Productions, formerly president of HBO Sports. I want to just end by asking Ross to give the audience a quick, you can do a quick plug specifically on Road to Winter Classic, which is coming up really soon. So how can everybody check out Ross Greenberg Productions, and specifically what should they be following for the next the NHL series?
So December 16th, Epics, 10 o'clock Eastern, four consecutive weeks right through the outdoor classics that are going to be played on January 1st and 2nd. So we'll be going December 16, 23, 30, and then January 6th, where we'll recap what happened on those two games outdoors on January 1st and 2nd. So get to your television sets and enjoy the power of NHL hockey and what goes on behind the scenes with four outstanding NHL teams.
That's terrific. Well, Ross, on behalf of Columbia, thank you very much. Really appreciate the time and look forward to this series coming up on December 16. I hope everybody can watch it. Joe, thanks for another great episode, and we'll see everybody next time on The Cusp Show.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Cusp Show, the Columbia University Sports Podcast. I'm Tom Richardson, and my co-host is Joe Favorito. And our production assistant this week is Columbia student Maurice Eisenman. You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple's podcast app, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and other key platforms. You can also find it at blogtalkradio.com/The Cusp Show. And you can get in touch with us on Twitter at CU_SPS_sports. Also, you can find out more about our program, the Columbia University Sports Management Program, by going online at sps.columbia.edu/sports-management. Thank you very much. We'll see you next time.